Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. I'm chatting today with Professor Simon Lewis, who is a Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre. He's also a neurologist. Hello, Simon, and thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
You've written about what is a fascinating subject to me, and that's rapid eye movement sleep behaviour disorder. What is that?
So normally during sleep, you've got to remember that sleep is a very dynamic process. It's not passive. There's lots of things happening. And we see stages of sleep. I think the general public are used to the idea of slow wave sleep. We've kind of gotten away with using that for a few years and gone away from it now to having this classification of non-rapid eye movement sleep, which encompasses what used to be slow wave sleep, and then rapid eye movement sleep. And during rapid eye movement sleep, what's supposed to happen is that the body is supposed to be paralyzed. So you're supposed to go atonic, so the muscles go floppy. You're allowed to breathe, and your eyes can roll around in their sockets, and the ears, the muscles in the ossicles can actually work still. And the brain is in a very aroused state. So the brain is dreaming, and so there's a lot of activity going on. But if you think from an evolutionary point of view, if you were acting out your dreams and lions and tigers and whatever could find you, that wouldn't be a good thing. So essentially the brain paralyzes the body in normal circumstances. So that's a great system. So when that system breaks down, you have a problem. That is, you know, you have dreams which often are, have got violent content. So you might be fighting or you're running. In Australia, we have a lot of sportsmen, so they're playing rugby and tackling people or jumping for a ball. Snakes are very common themes. So the dreams are usually quite violent, and they can lead to injuries. So, you know, it's about a third of patients will either injure themselves or a bed partner. And, you know, that can be quite serious. I mean, I've seen patients who've broken their wrist. I met somebody just on the weekend who managed to put his hand through a pane glass window and ended up having stitches on his wrist. So it's insignificant at all.
I mean, we all twitch in our sleep sometimes, surely.
I think what people always worry about is, you know, my son is a sleepwalker or a sleep talker. Does that mean he's going to get this? And the answer is no. So we talk about parasomnias, things that happen during sleep. And basically, non-REM parasomnias include all of those things that you might be more familiar with: sleep walking, sleep talking, people who get up in the middle of the night, start eating and don't remember it. But with REM sleep behavior disorder, we're very much limited. So if patients do try and leave the bed, generally they'll fall, they don't get very far, and at that point they'll injure themselves and maybe wake up. So the truth of the matter is that it's not the same as those non-REM parasomnias that are much more frequent. And in actual fact, people having REM sleep behavior disorder or RBD is a very small percentage, less than 0.5% of the general public have it. But then, of course, where the interest comes is from some of the studies that were done, you know, approaching 20 years ago now, where people recognize the association between RBD and patients with synuclein pathology. And synuclein pathology is what we see down the microscope and in the brain of people with Parkinson's disease, Lewy body dementia, and more rarely a condition called multiple system atrophy, which most people remember from medical school is a bit like Parkinson's, but it's the one which has bad balance and a poor autonomic nervous system, so dropping your blood pressure, bladder doesn't work. So those three diseases share a common pathology when you look down at the cells that are dying. That's inclusions of synuclein protein, which is tangled. And really the number of patients who have RBD in those diseases is very high. And in actual fact, when studies have been done looking at, I think it was 172 cases of people confirmed to have RBD during life, when you do the post-mortem, over 95% will have one of those three synuclein-based diseases. So it is a very strong relationship. So that was the first part of the story. And I guess the second part of the story was really looking at those people who didn't have an obvious brain disease but had developed RBD. And we're talking here about people who are over the age of 50 and really trying to exclude other things that might disrupt sleep. So we know that sleep apnea, you know, you can wake up with a confusion or arousal. It looks like you're acting out your dreams.
Yes.
We know that alcohol, we know that certain drugs can change the circuitry in the brain. So if you can exclude those, if you like, secondary causes of why you might act out your dreams, and you're left with saying, well, can't think of a good reason here, then following those patients is really very interesting. There are now a couple of good studies out there that have shown that with patients who have this idiopathic RBD, really they seem to be going on to develop a synuclein disease. So over 15 years of following patients up, over 80% of cases will end up getting Parkinson's, Lewy body dementia, and more rarely multiple system atrophy. So it's a very, and people who are in this field say, look, we've studied our patients for a bit longer, and it looks like everybody goes on and gets one of these diseases. It's a really strong relationship that's important.
If a patient comes in and is asymptomatic for those neurodegenerative disorders, but has RBD, what do we tell them? and when do we tell them? And how does it help us diagnose or even prevent the onset of their neurodegenerative disorders?
Yeah, look, and I think there's a lot of components in that question.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. The first thing, I guess, is, okay, well, doc, let's have a look at this question of REM sleep behavior disorder. You said that if you have this, the chance of you getting one of these diseases, you know, over the next 15 years is quite high. But, you know, what are we really talking about? And as I say, people might be familiar with losing a sense of smell as being a risk factor for developing Parkinson's in later life. And really what we're talking about is an odds ratio that's increased by maybe 3 to 4 times. With this RBD, what we're talking about is an odds ratio increase of 140 times. We can be much more confident. Now, the next question, I guess, is, well, okay, doc, if you can predict who's going to get dementia with Lewy bodies or Parkinson's, does it matter? And the answer at the moment is, of course, we don't have a disease-modifying treatment, but really only in the last couple of weeks we've seen in The Lancet a paper from one of my old colleagues in Cambridge, Tom Fultony, who's now in London, suggesting that a repurposed diabetes drug, exenatide, might in fact slow the course of people who've got Parkinson's disease. There we're talking about a disease-modifying treatment, small phase 2, needs corroboration now in a bigger study. But here we're saying, well, look, by the time you're first diagnosed with Parkinson's, you might have lost 50% of those dopamine-containing cells in the substantia nigra that we're always learning about. But if we're talking about REM sleep behavior disorder, the question is, well, if we had something that could slow the course of the disease before we even got the physical manifestations or the cognitive decline of Lewy body dementia, well, actually, it might be even more effective to give those patients a go beforehand. And there are studies out there that have looked at those other things that can, if you like, contribute to risk. I mentioned losing your sense of smell, but also losing your ability to discriminate colors. These are sort of very clever tests that we can run in the clinic, not necessarily in a research setting rather than in a jobbing clinic. But that coupled with something like small handwriting. So if there's anything physical, plus this lack of smell, plus the poor color discrimination, then in actual fact, the numbers get a bit more interesting. So if we took the figure and said, look, we know that 15 years down the track, 80% of these patients will get a disease. Well, if you actually bundle these risk factors with RBD, so losing a sense of smell, color vision, some physical symptom, the risk of transitioning over the next 3 years is actually 65%. So people have actually done the studies to say, well, look, if we had a disease-modifying drug that could, if you like, impact the progression from RBD to Parkinson's, for example, how many patients would you need to study? And the answer is 100 on the drug and 100 on the placebo. After 3 years, you'd probably have a significant result. So I'm not suggesting for 1 second that we have a cure, but I think this is the conversation that I think we should be having as doctors where, you know, often we've taken the approach of a bit parochial, we know what's best for our patients, but in actual fact, Professor Google is out there and our patients will find Professor Google's opinion and then they'll be concerned about our opinion and our advice. So
yes.
I think the answer is we have to start having a conversation that says, look, in an individual case, we're not sure whether you're going to get this disease. We're not sure if you are going to get disease, when it will be or what type of disease. But we are convinced that there's a risk and therefore we know that there's studies that will come in the future. And right now there are some positive things you can do. So there's no harm in taking up exercise or physiotherapy or speech therapy or exercise that will improve your speech, brain training, doing, you know, those programs that are online that can improve your mentation. And so I think that there are some positives that we can spin to our patients rather than almost, you know, sort of saying, well, we don't know what you've got. We don't know when you'll get it. We don't know if we've got a cure. You know, those are negative messages.
Yeah.
I think we can give positive messages at this time.
So if I'm a GP and my patient comes in and complains that they're, you know, thrashing them out in bed and their wife reckons they've beaten them up, what do we do? How do we diagnose RBD separate it out from the other diagnoses?
So I think in general practice, you know, the first thing is to listen out for that story and not just dismiss it.
Yeah.
And I think then probably the first port of call is going to be a sleep doctor. or if there is a neurologist who has a particular interest in this field, like myself and others, then you might go there directly. But the sleep doctor will help you with teasing apart, is this a problem related to sleep apnea? And through polysomnography, so overnight sleep study, you can actually see evidence for this RBD in patients. So we do record from the muscles with an EMG recording during polysomnography. And of course, during dream sleep, which we can stage from the EEG during that polysomnogram recording, you can say, well, is the muscle activity as it should be, as in missing?
Yes.
Or is there activity there? Can we see on these overnight infrared cameras people thrashing around in their dreams? And I think that then adds weight. And of course, you can review things like alcohol history, medications. Are they on anything that might be triggering this behavior before we, you know, ascribe this as idiopathic? So I think once you've done that and you're left with idiopathic, then I think you do probably need a neurologist to cast their eye over the patient, looking hard for signs of Parkinsonism. Looking hard, is there any element of cognitive decline here that might suggest a Lewy body dementia pattern? And if they're able to do any testing like, you know, simple smell testing, you know, sniffing sticks or, you know, these scratch and sniff tests that are available. And even just, you know, simple, you know, can you smell perfume? Can you smell strong, you know, flavors of food? So I think that those elements can all help us.
What's the management plan after that?
So, look, I think one of the things that we often neglect is we get excited about what does this pathology mean? And the answer is it often dwarfs, well, what about me punching in my sleep and falling out of bed, Doc?
Yes.
And the answer is, well, we do have treatments that are quite effective at stopping RBD. Now, we don't necessarily think that that's going to modify the risk of developing a disease in the future, but we know that the sort of two common streams to that would be a benzodiazepine called clonazepam, used at low dose, starting in my practice at 0.25 milligrams as late as you can before you go to bed, because we know most of dream sleep happens in the second half of the night.
Yeah.
And the maximum dose I would go up to is 2 milligrams. The concern with the benzodiazepines, of course, is that they might make your patient a bit drowsy the next day, affect gait and cognition, and maybe in a falls risk, as it were. And then the other treatment, which I tend to prefer, is to use slow-release melatonin. Now, that isn't licensed on our PBAC and through PBS, but it is relatively cheap through a compounding chemist. And I generally start people at a 4 milligram dose, again, as late as possible before going to bed, of a controlled-release preparation of melatonin. And generally, that's often enough to stop these dream enactments and reduce the violent behavior. If people are saying, look, it's very infrequent and it's not a problem, then that's not such an issue. But, you know, even then, safety precautions, is there anything on the bedside cabinet? Is there something that we could,
yes,
you know, a bolster between your partner and yourself so that you don't lash out? And a number of patients will say, oh, you know, we don't sleep in the same room. And it's often the case that they've made up a story and said, oh, it was because he snores, or I was worried about disturbing her. And so in actual fact, it may well be that this has been going on for a lot longer. And people have reported 20 years before you get Parkinson's sometimes, these patients are acting out their dreams. So it's one of those things to ask about. But certainly there are simple non-pharmacological and pharmacological approaches that can go on.
You mentioned it briefly while you were talking then, but is there any knowledge about whether or not stopping RBD could have a mitigating effect on the development of these later diseases?
Yeah, so it's a very good thought. We certainly don't see any strong evidence from the data we have, because I guess what you'd be arguing is, well, if we think it's going to stop the synuclein disease, then all of those patients who might have been taking melatonin or clonazepam for their REM sleep behavior disorder, you might anticipate that their disease would progress more slowly. And we're not seeing evidence for that, although it's quite tricky to construct those prospective trials. And you don't know when the timing might be. There have been some suggestions that melatonin as an antioxidant might help with disease modification, but certainly we don't have any evidence at this stage, either, you know, circumstantial or prospective.
Do we know much about the pathogenesis of RBD?
So, unfortunately, because the phenomenon is you know, happening in a human brain, we're sort of limited. So we obviously think about the pathology of people who are, if you like, pre-Lewy body disease, like Parkinson's or Lewy body dementia, and know that the disease seems to be spreading up the brain stem. So people have implicated regions of the pons, so pontine nuclei, as being involved in trying to switch off the muscle activity that we have during REM sleep. But in terms of drawing out a circuit diagram, we're really scratching, because even if you use animal models, we don't have the same nuclei that animals have. So it's very tricky to then extrapolate and say, well, that's the circuitry there. And, you know, well, maybe we could do a surgery or something that would stop it. We just don't have that level of understanding. As I say, I think in some ways it's our brightest star for saying, well, who do we think we might target for a disease-modifying therapy? And not only in Parkinson's, but, you know, Lewy body dementia is second only to Alzheimer's as a cause of dementia. And I suspect a whole bunch of Alzheimer's patients probably sneakily have Lewy body dementia. And, you know, we're just not necessarily assessing them closely enough to detect that.
Boy, find the silver bullet for all of that and you'll...
Absolutely, that would be good, huh?
Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize coming your way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, we should be upbeat about these things. And
yes.
Say, look, you know, we don't want hype. We do want hope. And I think if you're a patient with REM sleep behavior disorder who has this, and, you know, I'm aware of a number of colleagues professionally who've got REM sleep behavior disorder, and they know that this is out there. And I think they need to hear the fact that actually this isn't all doom and gloom. I think there are some positives that we need to take.
Thanks for your time, Simon.
My pleasure.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.